master speaker. So see you all in Kansas City. Had anyone told me in May of 1955, when I had just completed a year's course in the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, taught by Martin Bernstein, tonight's speaker, that I would be introducing him at a banquet 35 years later, I would have been very, very much surprised. Were I to see Martin's distinctions, I myself might become a banquet speaker, because they're that long. Some of you may know him as the man who wrote the first college textbook on the history of music, called An Introduction to Music, which first appeared in 1936. Some of you may know that he played in the New York Philharmonic in the 1920s under Mengelberg and Toscanini and Furtwängler and a host of other distinguished conductors, and I suspect he may tell you something about that. Some of you may know also that he had a long and distinguished 48-year academic career at New York University in its music department, and for 15 of those years as chairman of its graduate musicology program. So I won't tell you any of those things. I'll tell you one very, very brief story about Martin instead, which tells a good deal about him. Because he was bilingual, in the Second World War, he was drafted, as it were, into Army intelligence, and it was his job to interrogate German war prisoners. The general psychology in dealing with German war prisoners was to demoralize them. And Martin at the time had not become quite the world-renowned Bach expert that he was to become, or quite so well-known as the world-renowned Wagner expert that he was to become, but he would get a prisoner, and they would start conversing very casually in German, and then Martin would say, well, where are you from? And the prisoner would mention some small town in Germany, and Martin would say, oh, really? Well, Bach passed through there in 1717. And the German, in utter amazement, would say, how do you know this? To which Martin would quickly respond, well, you know, in America, we have very good elementary schools. I think that gives you a very good idea of what you're going to hear this evening. I have been very fortunate to have been Martin Bernstein's student. I feel very fortunate to have had Martin as a good friend. And I think every one of us sitting here this evening are fortunate to have him as a speaker. Martin?
I trust I am audible, understandable. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here tonight by invitation.
He's too far away from the mic.
Yeah, you have to
could he hold the mic in his hand? I think that would be better.
I believe you're going to eat it.
How do I sound now? What's that quotation from Shakespeare dealing with our faults? How do I sound now?
Speak very close.
His feet should touch the. Your feet should touch that. Touch the.
How is it now? Well, I am in front of this device now, my invitation, and I am also here because about 60, almost 70 years ago, I wanted to play in a high school orchestra. And so I went to the high school music teacher, told him I wanted to play. He took one look at me and said, you're a big boy, take this bass home. I took the bass home, and now I shall proceed to tell you why I'm really a living, I don't want to call myself an artifact, but I belong in a museum. Because I am associated with musical customs that prevailed in the 1920s. An enormous gap. When at that time, radio was a very good device. You had to go out and buy a 90-volt battery, as some of you recall, and you paid $5 a piece for tubes. Television was unheard of. Phonograph records were limited to very simple affairs. You could, for example, buy the last half of the last movement of the Fourth Tchaikovsky Symphony, conducted by Khan Book, for example. Very few things were available. Not just in recording as we know it now. So therefore, I can recall for you things that might be hard to believe. Well, here I was, a youngster with a double bass. I went to Wurlitzer, to then the supply musical instruments for all of the schools. I see some heads nodding. And at Wurlitzer on 42nd Street, I bought a self-instructor, the Eclipse self-instructor, for 25 cents. And it had a piece of paper that you pasted on the fingerboard, and that showed you where the notes were. After 1 year of that, I felt duly qualified to apply for a job in a motion picture theater orchestra. Now, to come to the movies of those days, first, the orchestras. The orchestras were non-union, and the players in the orchestra were recruited from all ranks of society, mostly illiterate, what you say, unalphabetic foreigners. Who played strange instruments. For example, the clarinetist in that orchestra that I was playing tied his reed to the instrument with a piece of string. And what is more, he held the reed on the top of the instrument instead of below. The trombone was a valve trombone. Now, the valve trombone has secured a certain degree of respectability today because you can find it in jazz bands. But in my day, the valve trombone was only played in National Guard bands and maybe in conflict bands and the like. It was a comparatively crude instrument, and what is more, its lowest note was E, as some of you are brass players will know. If you have to use all the valves, the instrument is terribly sharp. And here I am playing a double bass whose lowest note is E, which is in tune, and there I was fighting with the trombone all the intonation. What did the orchestra consist of, and how did you get there? In those days, the theater musicians were recruited from the paper. I answered an ad in the Telegram. It said, Face wanted the Parthenon Theater. And I'm looking to do a crystallization, I assure you. What did I do? I just went there and said that I play bass. Nobody asked me how well. So I bought the theater, bought the bass. The bass brought to the high school. I didn't know one of my own. I was engaged. I should also mention, at that time, I was a senior in high school, and New York City schools, much better then than they are today, was nevertheless rather crowded, and we went on what's so-called double session. So I went to high school from 8 to 12:30, and then repaired out to the Motion Picture Theater in Richwood, and we played from 2 to 5, and then from 7 to 11. The orchestra was peculiar. It was rather small, it was in a pit. It consisted of a violinist, leader, another violin, no viola, no cello, and then a double bass. And while the double bass, the neck of the instrument stuck up above the pit and made it look like an orchestra. No bass, no orchestra. One flute, wooden flute, one clarinet, and then trumpet, trombone, and what were then called the traps, including almost any noise maker possible, no kettle drums, or things of that type. Now, what sort of music do we make? I can only tell you that it's all so far back in history that I have been interviewed twice by individuals writing PhD theses on the old motion picture. The only reason why I'm here today, despite my age, is that I was young then and survived. The fact that I don't know anyone else who ever did that. Now, what sort of music we play? First place, the music was silent. The orchestra, the picture was silent. It always consisted of, in those days, what we call a newsreel. Some of you may recall the Pathé newsreels. A newsreel, and then a one-reel scenic, what we call today a travel picture. And then a feature. The feature was always classified by a number of reels. If it was a seven-reel feature, that was a big event. And then I should also mention the orchestra also included an organ. I'm speaking now of neighborhood movies. I'm not speaking of those big movies, movie palaces on Broadway. There were four of them in those days, but I'll come to them later. Now, what do we play? How do we play it? Before the before the show began, or the week before, the leader would get a cue sheet. By the way, the leader had his own library, and the music that we played was limited to his library. The cue sheet was always in terms of the titles on the bizarre movie. The title of the silent movie. You knew exactly from the title what was going to come. And so therefore each scene was described in fairly basic, very often in Italian, amoroso, tragico, and things of that character. And the music that we played was always some excerpt, and you stopped playing it when the leader gave the sign. You played and stopped, played and stopped. What sort of music was it? A lot of it was prepared for the occasion by excellent musicians who knew the 19th century literature. Those the 19th century romantic literature with always with colorful orchestration. It fitted the needs of those who pictured very well indeed. Now, on the other hand, the music that they never kept the titles. Here I was, kid of 16. What was I playing as the cowboys dash across the plain? Agitato number 3. Later in life, I discovered that Agitato number 3 was what? The Erlkönig. But never under its name. Then for when burglars climbed up the roof, up this porch, we played something known as Mysterioso number 2. What was Mysterioso number 2? It was an extract from Weber's opera, Der Freischutz. At the end of the act of the Freischutz, there's a scene, the casting of magic bullets. Most vivid. I didn't know it was still messed up with nothing else but Mysterioso number 2. Now, the music, then the music sometimes, to make it a little more emphatic, the pieces that we played were given titles. So, there was extracted from the lovely work of Saint-Saëns, some of you may know it, Enfant's Spinning Wheel, what do you mean, Enfant? In the middle of that, there's a description of Hercules trying to free himself from Enfant's toils. Long bass passage. That was caught. I knew it for many years only by its name, the Slimy Viper. and many others. All of the music, by the way, was a tribute to the individuals who knew that vast literature of the 19th century. I have a sneaking suspicion that the names utilized did not fall to the individual who did it. For example, a great deal of music was composed of, that's clear, or arranged by one D. Savino, S-A-V-I-N-O, what you would call. I don't know who D. Savino was, but he had a namesake or a palindrome, Onivus. Then there was another man called Gaston Borch, Otto Langley, and then there was a famous character, Charles J. Roberts. But he existed or not, I don't know. But Roberts used to compile for us these selections from various operas. Very often those are playing in restaurants. What then did we play for the rest of the show? For the newsreel, we always had available any fast one step for the horse race, invariably. The conclusion of the overture to Orpheus, the Orpheus noted on the Broadway. Da 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 da. But then there was always a funeral march. As for the scenic, it was always a waltz. Most of the time, the waltz that some of you may recall, Sove las ollas, over the waves, da 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 da, etc. So forth. Came the movie with sound. The first one was the jazz singer with Jan with Al Jolson. And by that time, I was in the Philharmonic. We played for that, to my parents' great delight, great sorrow. The camera stand, the orchestra, and stopped at the 7th double bass, and I was the 8th. let's come back. From the movies, I graduated into the musical comedy. That also had an entirely different cast than it has today. The first place, they were elegant. There was nothing scatological, pornographic, or anything else about them. They were really practically operettas as we know them today. I played with Eddie Cantor, for example, with Kid Boots, who was Joe. The orchestra in the pit was a miniature symphony orchestra. There was no piano, for example. The orchestra consisted of every wind instrument of the orchestra. In a musical comedy, mind you, we had a trumpet and we had oboe and bassoon. And to make it look classy, we even had a harp. So what in heaven's name the harp did that I don't know, except complain to me, the outside round the outside of it, except I complain about the fact that composers did not know how to write for the harp. Harpers still consider themselves a persecuted race. Because of the most individuals think it's just the harp, uses two slaves, it's essentially a piano. But actually the harp plays much more with his feet, as you may have heard, than he does with his hands. Now, my life, I shouldn't speak now so I can deliver you a eulogy in my funeral, but my life is a series of very fortunate events. My headstone could read, "Here lies serendipity." How come I began to become an orchestral musician? I was a physics student. In fact, if I'd gone on normally in life, I would have been high school teacher of physics. But somebody gives me a double bass. Now I'm in college playing the double bass, and the head of the music department is a violinist, and he's also a conductor at the Summer of the New York Symphony in Chautauqua. I am asked to join him one day in a public performance of Mozart's and a Kleinenbach music, which can be played without double bass, but there I was playing with five players, and he was rather impressed. In fact, I practiced it heavily the day or two before. Having done that, he says to me, "Well, come with me this summer and play with the New York Symphony." For me? But I went, and mind you, after 4 weeks in the New York Symphony, I have bought the title Symphony Man. And so therefore, the following year, when there was an opening in the Philharmonic, and the bass players were scarce, here I was, the Symphony Man. And so I went into the Philharmonic without audition. In fact, I never played an audition in my life. But those are the way things were in those days. The bass was then a rare instrument. I'll tell you about the difference in the musical life, and I compare it with later on. And here I went then into this orchestra, a kid of 21. Mind you, there were no phonograph records then, as there are now, to acquaint me with the literature. And what is more, I started at the stadium, where we played 7 concerts a week with 2 rehearsals, which meant that the second night I was in the orchestra, I had to play the 4th Symphony of Tchaikovsky at sight. I never heard it. The symphony, and so forth. Compare that with an individual who starts in a symphony orchestra today. Everything that he's going to play, or almost everything, has been recorded. He can study it beforehand. It's not news to him at all. Now, let me tell you about the Philharmonic in those days, as compared to today. Perhaps my comparison will be a bit more vivid if I tell you what it was like now, what it is like now. Today, thanks to the overproduction of performers by our music schools, our orchestras are composed almost entirely of Americans. They are college graduates, and they are there in profusion. If today there is an opening for a player in a symphony orchestra, it must first be advertised. Then you send in, if you think you're capable, you send in a tape. And of those tapes that are sent in, they'll probably select 100, the 200 that are sent in. And now you will fly out to Minneapolis at your own expense, if you're carrying a cello or a bass, paying double fare, and you will compete. And you will be heard, not by the conductor, but you will be heard by a committee of members of the orchestra, and what's more, will be a screen in front of you. And of that 100, 99 will go away heartbroken, and incidentally, they're all good to start out with. If anybody wanted to gauge them arithmetically, they have to use these 4 or 5 digits beyond the decimal point. Now, what happened? Furthermore, once they're engaged, after 2 or 3 years, they have tenure. In my day, this is what happened. First place, you were usually engaged how? Through your teacher. It was a, we can't call it nepotism, I suspect, but it was definitely an example of Paul being better than Bush. Your teacher is really the employment agency for his students. And in fact, that he was the first player in an orchestra like Philharmonic, he had conductors call him up around the country, ask him to recommend his students. You came into the orchestra, and again, you always could be fired at the end of the season. You could be harassed by the conductor. You might stay, you might get a pension after the end of 20 years. You're still in the orchestra. But that pension, in my day, was an optional management. And when you were retired, you got a pension of $1,200 a year, equal to $23 a week. Well, birthdays occur. We were paid $70 a week. Most people have no idea of the life of an orchestra man, orchestra player. There's very little literature about it. To the best of my knowledge, they have novels about a great many professions. Nobody's ever written a novel about life in the orchestra and the toll that it exacts on the players. There is a peculiar orchestra in Vienna. It's not called the Vienna Philharmonic. It's called the Wiener Philharmonica. It's hard to translate. The Vienna Philharmonic players is an aggregation of individuals. Nevertheless, they have their problem, and a psychiatric study has been made of them. Perhaps it's easy to make psychiatric studies of Viennese, and there are plenty of Viennese who like to make the psychiatric study. It's Freud City, after all. I have home a book which I encourage to translate. It's by the principal second violin of the Vienna Philharmonic. The title in German is Und für dies wird man bezahlt. And for this, you are paid. And how did that happen? At a certain one of their concerts, Fitwanger was conducting. As the players are packing up their instruments, probably been a marvelous concert, the second clarinet said to the first, and for this you get paid. That's one aspect of playing in the orchestra. But the price you pay very often is the price in your own self-respect and also self-respect in tedium. I was only 2 years in the Philharmonic, but I was already groaning at the prospect of playing the Tchaikovsky Fifth again. Then the players who were often annoyed by the length of works. They've almost been heretical in their statements. I recall going on the stage, the man behind me saying, we're going to play the Royal Symphony, by the way. The man behind me said, oh, this piece is too long. And I said, where do you want to make the cuts? That's the answer. Now, when you tell people you played the orchestra, you played the Philharmonic, and you might say, in 2 years, you played with 11 different conductors, great conductors, and they did. And then they would immediately say, and you played with Toscanini? Yes. What was it like? Toscanini was the terror that everybody wanted to do it. The truth of the matter about it, that is, there were other great conductors. Toscanini was the greatest, but there are others, I shouldn't say comparable. I don't want to consult the Toscanini enthusiasts here. But I must tell you that there were three greats among those 11. The first was Mengelberg, my first Jupiter daughter. The trouble with the Mengelberg tragedy, I will say, is that so little of his music was recorded. He was he belonged to a school of conducting and performance that's now outmoded. Mengelberg insisted on a flexible tempo, changing the tempo to suit the occasion. I might tell you that large symphonic works written in what we professionally call sonata form can be likened to dramas, as opposed to regular Baroque music, which is dealing with one character. Here we now have several different styles. Mengelberg did not let them walk on one after the other. He would stop and pause, make us realize that the music was changing. Later composers would write that into the music. Tchaikovsky has two or three tempi in one movement. Now Beethoven, in a first movement, Mengelberg made those things clear. He insisted on expressive performance, and so therefore there's a considerable amount of what we call portamento, the sliding for one note, that character is made. Today, that's not considered fashionable. I use that word fashion advisedly. Fashion many represents current taste. There are no absolute tastes in music. But to let you know what else goes on in the orchestra, besides just the concert, there is always the rehearsal. And rehearsal, generally speaking, is not liked because what you do in rehearsal, you learn someone else's idea of a classic that you already know well. And like as not, it may not be your idea, but you have to play it anyway. So it eventually becomes something like a linotyper who works away from the machine, not aware of the fact that he is creating literature on it. You see, in Mengelberg particularly, the conductor's propensity to lecture the orchestra. This became quite burdensome for the concertmaster and the first cello. They had to listen. The rest of the orchestra paid no attention, or at least did what I've always told students to do in class. The conductor, if the teacher is boring, be at least polite and keep nodding your head from time to time, preferably with dark glasses. Nevertheless, it was Mengelberg who took on the Philharmonic and taught it. He may have been a schoolmaster, but he instilled in that orchestra a precision, an accuracy that made it possible for Toscanini to accomplish what he did. If Toscanini had to stop the Philharmonic without Mengelberg's preparation, the success would not have been half as great. But you also observed in the orchestra the vanity of the conductor and the capacity for cruelty. The conductor was a tyrant. Sometimes he might even be described as a somewhat benevolent Simon the Green. His cruelty on occasion. Here's exactly what happened one occasion. The soloist, I should also mention that conductors always represent soloists as illegal competition for the audience, of course. But on the other hand, as you may have noticed, orchestras whose conductors do not have satisfactory appeal on their own will always bring in the soloist to compensate for the composer conductor's deficiencies. In this case, the soloist was a charming young lady, obviously was about the middle 20s, and she was going to play the second Rachmaninoff concerto with us. The second Rachmaninoff, as you know, begins shallow, solo, rather improvisation on character, and then the orchestra comes in with the big two. She sits down the piano, plays only a few notes, then her taps. I play this with Rachmaninoff. You don't play it that way.
Yeah.
What happened to the poor girl? Practically destroyed on the spot. She played at the concert, but that was the end of it. The conductor showed his dislike for the soloist by always begrudging him rehearsal time. The soloist always appeared at the last rehearsal. If that was it was our Thursday night concert, he appeared Thursday morning. Same time as we did, 10 o'clock. And he sat there in the back until finally Mengelberg was saying, Mr. So-and-so, we're ready for you now. Well, the soloist that time was none other than the, at that time, world-famous Rudolf Ganz. And Ganz was going to play the Schumann Concerto with us on Thursday and Friday, and he was going to play the Liszt concerto on Sunday afternoon. He's called up for his rehearsal. The Schumann in the last moment was a bit tricky. A lot of time was consumed. And as the Schumann ended, so did rehearsal time. Mecklenburg then turns to the orchestra and says, "Gentlemen, you know the Liszt concerto, don't you?"
"Of course."
"Thank you, Mr. Gotts." He played the Liszt concerto with us that Sunday afternoon with no rehearsal. Mecklenburg also, let it be said to his credit, was a frustrated exponent of Mahler in the United States. He had been very friendly with Mahler. Mahler had entrusted Mecklenburg with the performances of all of his symphonies in 1920. Mecklenburg gave a Mahler festival in Amsterdam, where all of the Mahler symphonies were performed. Now he comes to America, and our public at that time would have none of Mahler. In fact, Arthur Judson, the manager of the Philharmonic, warned Mecklenburg about programming Mahler. Nevertheless, Mecklenburg programmed what is now one of the most popular of the Mahler symphonies, namely the fifth, with now the famous Adagietto, which reaches its triumph when it was played in St. Patrick's Cathedral for the funeral of Robert Kennedy. I'm going to tell you this. At the Friday afternoon concerts, the hall was practically empty. Everybody walked out rather than hear the law. What happened today? Record company after record company issues complete sets of Mahler. I must tell you, restoring the Mahler and recordings is going to be a problem for all your record players. But poor Mecklenburg, he was put into a glitch by New York's rediscovery of Toscanini. When I joined the orchestra, it was the second season of Toscanini. When I got there, I was immediately warned, "Watch out, Toscanini is coming. You could see that something was afoot." If you had been around the hall the week before Toscanini arrived, something unheard of in the musical world, the conductors were, orchestra were. Performers were going to the librarian and taking parts home to practice. Practicing is always supposed to be done on company time. And I recall coming into the hall that morning, we were going to do the Eroica Symphony, and 20 minutes before the rehearsal began, all the first 5 minutes were on the stage, they were practicing those scales in the first movie. Quite simple. Now we come then to the matter of Toscanini. This is controversial, at least I would like to think it's controversial, but the Toscanini appearance would not have never been this controversial. This is ipso facto, this is infinity itself, beyond which there can be nothing. Toscanini came on there, he comes in, typically, black jacket, not tight, but the top, quasi-military, picks up the baton, never the morning gentleman, or this such thing, the baton, pedal. Now, how come this man had the reputation he had, the acceptance that he had, even from men of the orchestra? First, of course, this fabulous memory. Hundreds of compositions available to him at all times. The ability to appear before a group of individuals and stamp himself upon them at once as a leader. Now, as you know, all of us meet each other and do an instantaneous appraisal, instantaneous inventory, whatever you do in England. When Toscanini appeared, you knew that he was in control and you were to follow. At no time would anybody willfully disobey him. Could it be? Now, the beat was a strong beat right to the shoulder here with an expression in the face, not only of conviction, but of determination. This is the way it's going to be. But you accepted that because you knew that he knew it, and his convictions were based on his extensive study of the score. Now, this EastEnders, this brief that he must adhere consistently to the composer's intentions, very often resulted in some rigidity. Some people call that rigidity accuracy and conformity. So some, it's called mechanical, particularly when his tempi were very fast. But nevertheless, with some composers, notably Wagner, for whom he had a very special affinity, the music really was glorious, and every one of us in the orchestra was thrilled. But now we come to these rehearsals. Let me tell you, at that time, the Philharmonic was only one-third American. Of this one-third, about 30-odd players, 34 or 5, only four were college graduates. Now, the European musicians were accustomed to taking commands from the conductor, not the Americans. There was a tremendous amount of, well, very raw and very nasty talk during the intermissions between rehearsals, casting aspersions on Toscanini's birth and a few other such things. His deficiencies of national origin, but nevertheless, they played. But the tone is the orchestra. The temper, at least if these tempers were necessary, I don't know. They can be debated. I asked a physician, prominent physician I know very well, what would have happened if we'd given Tuscany tranquilizers before the rehearsal? Well, I was told that it would diminish his musical acuity. But the assaults on dignity and self-respect of the performers are unbearable. Unfortunately, I suspect he was allowed to do that from the beginning, and when he appeared in the Philharmonic, it was a habit of at least 40 or 50 years existence. But I saw it. In fact, I was even myself the victim of it. This was a performance of the ninth rehearsal of the Ninth Symphony. It was called as an extra rehearsal on a Saturday morning in the winter. The orchestra then played 7 times a week. There were no days off. There were 4 concerts, 5 rehearsals, 7 so forth. 9 events in those 7 days. So the rehearsal was an extra rehearsal. He comes in and shouts, "Scherzo!" You know, it's a nice thing. "Scherzo!" Now, you'll recall that the second move of the Ninth Symphony, a famous scherzo with all the parts of the drums, begins with a few forte measures, very explosive, and then drops down to a practically inaudible pianissimo in which the second violins start. Don't be whispering, murmuring. It's a 5-part fugato. The last entry, curiously enough, is in the double basses alone. And now, as the name double bass should leave you to breathe, double bass seldom plays independently. It doubles the bass, usually in the cellos or the bassoons. Now, for reasons best known to himself, Beethoven puts that entry in the basses alone. And it's marked pianissimo. Tenors. And we make our entry, soft as possible, stop at once, shriek! Pianissimo. He yells at us. Well, that's what he says, yeah. And so we play again. This time, of course, as far as we're concerned, inaudible. But that didn't please us many. So, again, a third time. After which, he cursed us out at a tight end. I never made an exact translation of what he called us. It sounded like Top Tony, but I couldn't find that in any dictionary. Apparently, whatever the vilification was, he didn't know it. And he stormed off the stage. That rehearsal, which cost the Philharmonic over $1,000 then, ended right then and there. Less than 5 minutes after it started, we were free. the rest of the day. Imagine how we all felt. Nevertheless, on the following Thursday, we get a magnificent performance of the 970. But this dogging some individuals, very extremely cruel. We rehearsed once, and they performed a work which is now familiar, the Queen Mab Scherzo from Berlioz, Romeo and Juliet. It's a very delicate work indeed. It was not repertory at the time. In fact, most of the Philharmonic, except for some of the very old, much older men, had never played it. We go along, rehearsal, and with some of you, as we know, if you wrote the music, know when you hear at the very end, the antique cymbals come in, and the second clarinet plays in its lowest register and staccato. Can't hear me? The way should be played. But dear old Mr. Christman, who had been in the orchestra for about 25 years, had never seen this before. The idiom was quite contrary to the music of the clarinet, and what is more, Berlioz had put it in the second clarinet. Now, if you know something about the orchestra, you'll know that second clarinet solos are very rare indeed, enough to make the second clarinet nervous. And of course, he fumbled it, doesn't he? He stops, yells at it, screams. What happens then when he repeats it? It's even worse. The net result was, dear Mr. Christman was fired in the Philharmonic at the end of the season. If Berlioz had never written that, he should be in the book, he would still be in the orchestra, he would have been in the orchestra. For some time. But this is the Toscanini that we played with in the 1930s. This is not the Toscanini of the NBC. This is not the Toscanini who's playing the same things, in fact, over and over again, the NBC, to extensive publicity. Later on, Toscanini became the world symbol for correct performance. If it wasn't Toscanini, it wasn't any good. I just remind you, that about 19, I don't know the exact date, the Philharmonic made an appeal for funds. If you sent in your dollar or more to the Philharmonic, they would send you a photograph of Toscanini. But he has made, he did definitely raise the standards of orchestral playing in this country. And no matter what else you may say about his recordings, about the interpretation, the orchestral performance on them is still something to wonder at. And as far as the recordings are concerned, I think everybody knows that he hated recording, sensitive musician that he is. In fact, one can very well argue that any sensitive musician would hate a recording. The only recording that really is valid, that's truthful, is recording made an actual performance before an audience. It's a situation in which the performer is communicating with a band of individuals and conveying the composer's message as he sees it. Otherwise, what is happening? A group of men playing for no audience at all. In fact, they're not even dressed for the occasion. The color they wear at recordings is comfortable. There's somebody standing there with a watch to make sure that the movie is finished within time. Certain compositions years ago could be heard in two or three tempi, depending on whether they are made on a 12-inch record or a 10-inch record. same conductor, same composition. But this continued with Toscanini. There begins the cult of the conductor, and glorified before the world at large, the conductor not only is artist, but is dictator. It's an extension of what happened to Wagner years ago. Of the local military folk. And he was always dogged by performances of the Grand March in Cantano. At one of these performances, Wagner came to the bandmaster and congratulated him on the performance. I'll give it to you in original German and then I'll translate it. Ja, Herr Wagner, said the Kellmeister, komponieren, das kann jeder machen. Spielen, das ist die Hauptsache. Translated, yes, Herr Wagner, anybody can compose, but playing, performance, that's the right. And that became, that was one of the reflection today in the coach of the virtuoso conductor. The important thing is you go to the conductor's performance, you watch the conductor, and listen to the orchestra, how the orchestra responds to it, maybe the composition itself may have some work. But the recording also is a doubtful curiosity. It's something to study, exactly as you study the print, the print reproduction of a painting in the museum. It gives you a good idea of the substance, but not much more. Now the third conductor in our play group is Fritz Wagner. Fritz Wagner is not like any other conductor. In fact, he was a reduction of a contradiction in terms. He was a conductor without a beat. In fact, one English composer conductor with Cromwell once asked him, how do you follow that beat? He said, well, you wait until your patience wears out, then you commit. made possible by the virtuoso orchestras he conducted. Fritz Wagner was the successor to Mish Nikish. When Fritz Wagner came to conduct the Philharmonic, he was one of the most famous conductors in Europe. He was a conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic, of the Leipzig Orchestra, successor to Mish Nikish. In Vienna as well, the Vienna Orchestra, the Vienna Philharmonic, usually engage their own conductors. Fritz Wagner, was one of their favorites. How then did he create his wonderful performances? They're always being compared with those meetings by his facial expression, by the motion of his arms, by the look on his face, which make you feel that this is the way to be played. I'm sorry that TV was never captured Fritz Wagner, of course. Of course, one of the model aspects of TV is it always focus on the conductor. But the gift of the Wagner for seeing expression on this tall, gangly man's face. He was by no means elegant. He talked not too much to the orchestra. He was a highly educated man. He was a composer in his own right. And when he conducted, he was so engaged in music, he didn't forget. In fact, he used to salivate a good bit. And it was said that if you will play with Kurt Wagner, and you will disperse by him, of course, cello, then you better come to rehearsal with an umbrella. But he once, playing with him, really demanded that you play as if you were a member of a string quartet. You have to keep your eye at everybody so that you cohere. Of course, he was not doing that. He was interpreting the music. As a result, playing a concerto with Kurt Wagner was definitely a very painful affair. Trying to keep him. I recall personally the performance of one of his most famous works, famous interpretations, the First Symphony of Brahms. Last movement. You know that famous tune. Da 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 da. Used to be the theme song of the New York Aggies in the 1940s. Well, that returns later on the work. The orchestra finally comes to the rest, and just before there's one, two is silent. Three is the pizzicato, clunk, in the basses alone. One, two, clunk, coffee. Well, here we are, 10 of us waiting for the clunk. It must be there, the violin won't start without it. Again, once more, when you come in, when your patience wears out. He felt this bounce hybrid, but of course, it wasn't played certain meaning-wise, all of us together. So it cascaded down the bass section. It made no difference. It made no difference at all. The grand line was there. It's as if you were to criticize that would be to criticize a great actor on the stage because he fled a line or two. But Hoeflander also had his moments. Again, this dislike for the conductor, for the soloist, excuse me. It's a cruel thing when Avicii made his debut with us. What did the Philharmonic management do? He made his debut that night, and so did Blanca Horowitz. That was a curious occasion. The hero, the Tchaikovsky, the first Tchaikovsky piano concerto, the conductor really hangs the soloist a very hot potato. The orchestra is playing a series of scales, singing, and the pianist has to pick it up at that tempo, then he can slow down. Well, Thursday night, Peachin gave him a comfortable tempo. He took it, played it right through. The concert performance was quite a sensation. The papers the next morning were full of praise of fireworks. But Friday afternoon, Peachin apparently was tired of all this. He took a much faster tempo. Horowitz couldn't cope with it. But it was Friday afternoon, and we were hoping. But to come back to this behavior with soloists, I know the story, I wasn't there, of one soloist who expressed his opinion of the conductor and everything else. That soloist was none other than Joseph Hoffman, the first director of the Curtis School. And one of the world's greats, as everybody knows. Unfortunately, I believe there was a recording one. Hoffman was on tour with Don Rush in the New York Symphony. And on tour, just to think of the way, a soloist will play more than one concerto. Well, Hoffman was that way, was playing the Liszt concerto, which offers, as you know, and the fourth Beethoven, which opens up very gently, very quietly, shallow. It was always Hoffman's habit to go to the movies the minute the orchestra arrived in town. He traveled by train there, and get to the hall at the last minute. A friend of mine sat right at the first stand of violins on the inside. As Hoffman walked across the stage, very bowing like, and he approached the piano, he said to him, "Which one? Which one?" Preparation for it. But on the other hand, later on, the other conductors, Bill Brown, who was one of them, did something really inexcusable. The soloist was in a Saturday night concert, so-called student concert, that had a very comparatively young audience, including what we call yuppie today, the young Apple Bow. And the soloist was to be a violinist who we all knew and loved, and his name is Bert Ocko, O-C-K-O. Ocko was quite famous. He had just taken his master's degree at Columbia. Now this again is in the 1920s, when most musicians are not that well educated. So he was quite the darling of the audience. Ocko was going to play the Brahms concerto. And so Saturday morning, he rehearsed the Brahms concerto. At the concert that night, it was announced the concerto will be conducted by Mr. Hans Langer, the assistant conductor. Hoeflander refused to conduct it. Today, of course, there are very few solos of symphony programs. The soloist have disappeared. In my day, the soloist could be a violinist, a pianist, and also a singer. The singer soloist has now disappeared. I recall Lawrence Melchior appearing with the Philharmonic singing the forging songs from the first act of Siegfried. You know, he schmied of my hammer, and he hits the anvil. I say, now what to do in the concert? Well, you can't give him an anvil to bang him in front of the stage. So they put the percussion players at the back of the orchestra, bang the anvil, one. Not your Sagan in front. The other individuals who appeared with the orchestra, that is Schumann,
appeared singing. She also sang Wagner. They're all gone now. The vocal soloists appear only in the large scale works. And what have we today now? By late group? There are orchestras of all, in fact, all American. The dictator, the tyrant, conductor has disappeared from the scene. In fact, he's under control, as it were. He would know better. The orchestra would walk out on him. When Zeman Mayer conducted the Metropolitan, he acted unwisely. He's never gone back. Today, there is an association of performers in symphony orchestras, the International Society of Symphony Performers, I don't know the exact title. Today, they pass judgment on conductors. Today, members of the orchestra sit on the board of directors, or trustees, and they help decide who the conductor will be. Every conductor today is, to some extent, at least partially, the choice of his players. Thank you very much.
It's getting relevant, right? If any of you have